Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Andrew Harrison. In 1980, Manchester was summed up in people's minds as Kevin Cummins' picture of Joy Division in Hume, looking miserable, bleak, around half-collapsed buildings. There's been a complete overturning of what Manchester means to young people. Now, investment decision makers around the world and people under 40 want a lifestyle which they are priced out of in London. That's today's guest, the writer and journalist Andy Spinoza, in the Manchester Evening News earlier this month, talking about his book, Manchester Unspun: Pop, Property and Power in the Original Modern City. This is, unusually, the story of how the resurrection of a dying industrial city was triggered not by development corporations or property speculators, but by pop culture and pop music. The waves of change triggered by Joy Division, the impresario Tony Wilson and his Hacienda Club, the Smiths, and then Manchester, house music and the Stone Roses, all had visible effect on Manchester. The book begins in 1980, when there were just 500 people living in the city centre and only five buildings over 20 stories high. And it ends with a quarter of a million of people living in Manhattan, with over 40 skyscrapers built and 40 more on the way. It's an account, from punk to the pandemic, of how the 1982 opening of the Hacienda gave the kiss of life to a dying city centre. So why did it happen there, and could the same magic work in other decaying cities? Andy Spinoza, welcome to The Bunker.
Hi, Andrew.
So the standing joke is that wherever you go in the world, you'll run into a Mancunian who says Manchester is the best place in the world, and whatever this place has got, there's a better one in Manchester. Where does that self-confidence come from?
I think the swagger, that's whether it's an intellectual swagger or Liam Gallagher's, you know, street walk, is from Manchester's history. You know, it was first industrial city in the modern world. Advances in science and technology, such as splitting the atom in the 20s, inventing the first proper computer in the 40s. It gave Manchester a sense of self-confidence, if you like, superiority. The writer Anthony Burgess always said travelling to London from Manchester was an exercise in condescension. And the founder of Granada TV, Sidney Bernstein, was often heard to say that what Manchester did today, London would get round to finding out about tomorrow. So, yeah, I think it's historical. And, of course, when I started my book, all that had really faded and was, I think the city had a sense of humiliation about it.
As you can tell by my accents, I'm from the other end of the M62. But I found the book fascinating. I mean, it's obviously been like a rival city to Liverpool, where I'm from. The interesting thing is that I was trying to think of other parallels where pop culture drove politics or regeneration, and the only ones I can think of are, you know, possibly Merseybeat, but Liverpool didn't really benefit. Possibly Tony Blair's Cool Britannia, that was almost a photo op thing. To what extent did music and pop culture really drive that change in Manchester?
Well, actually, the book was triggered by something that Tony Wilson said in 2007. He said, "I don't see this as the story of Joy Division." It was in a documentary about Joy Division. "I see this as the story of a city." The music that Joy Division made started this great reinvention of Manchester. And of course, at the time, you know, I thought, well, how pretentious, a classic, kind of absurdly preposterous, grandiose Wilsonian statement. But during lockdown, with time on my hands, I was able to really look back over 40 years. And as a journalist, as a PR man, I was able to look at the what I call sort of a daisy chain, really, of links between what started out as Bus Drivers Social Club in Hume, where the Factory Records gig nights were first put on with punk gigs, to this year opening £211 million Factory International, cutting edge art centre with £100 million of government money, announced by George Osborne in the House of Parliament, where he kind of praised Factory Records, like Conservative Chancellor praising a gang of countercultural revolutionaries. And yeah, I think I have been able to piece together this chain reaction.
It is hard to imagine George Osborne with a stack of Crispy Amelons and Stockholm Monsters records, isn't it? But I suppose that the connections are strange ones. You are an adopted Mancunian, as people can probably tell from your accents. And the book is like the parallel story of how you moved there and how it changed you, alongside how the city changed around you. You can't really be accused of too much pro Mancunian bias, because your granddad was a Scouser, I believe. Why did you move there?
The music was compelling to me. Buzzcocks my favourite act. I always see them in London. Actually, I was more influenced by the writings of people like Paul Morley and John Savage and Mick Middles in the NME and Sounds and the photography of Kevin Cummins. I was receiving a mediated image of Manchester through those weekly inkies that people of my generation will remember fondly. They were incredibly influential and acted as a sort of alternative tourist board for Manchester. All these kind of crumbling, decaying Gothic vistas with moody musicians peering, you know, through Kevin Cummins' camera lens. And the kind of characters, you know, Tony Wilson himself, who I was lucky to meet, you know, when I was a student, all acted as this sort of gravitational pull. And not just me, of course. I met people from all over the country, Manchester University, who were all as much into the music of the city as much as their course that they were allegedly studying.
Manchester was not the only decaying industrial city with an enormously rich music scene and the occasional tub-thumping impresario promoter. I mean, you know, Sheffield had music, Liverpool had music, and, you know, had the kind of heritage of radicalism, you know, the heritage of trade unionism, but also art and creativity and so on. So how come it happened in Manchester and not to the same extent elsewhere?
Well, it's a great question, and there are some books written about, you know, kind of compare and contrasts of, you know, Liverpool, Sheffield, Leeds, Newcastle, who all had, you know, similar heritages of going through similar problems. I think it's plain, it's not, you know, there's a long record of commentary on Manchester's political leadership. Mm. Ultimately, and my book, you know, explains this, Manchester's leadership ditched confrontational approach to central government and said, we want to work with the government. We want to get good at winning public money. We want to get good at partnerships with private money from the rest of the world, anywhere in the world. We will work with anyone who wants to put money into Manchester. And the key point is that those leaders in Manchester didn't dismiss the Manchester music scene as just a bunch of kids larking around. They could see that this was the way economies were changing. So Factory Records were sold around the world in their beautiful sleeves by Peter Saville, made the city seem an interesting place for artists and tastemakers. And of course, Hacienda Nightclub, while it became notorious in some respects, also led to things like the Newsweek magazine cover in 1990, the American sort of digest to Middle America told Americans all about the groovy things going down in Manchester.
It's interesting that you mentioned the trouble that Liverpool was having at the same time, because not a lot of people know that Factory and Tony Wilson did organise a benefit gig for Liverpool City Council. And this was a bill that was New Order, The Smiths and The Fall. And I think it was about 15 quid to get in. I went on the night. It was astonishing. Never seen anything like it. Yeah. But the idea that there was a kind of a rancorous rivalry between the cities, not entirely true. Wilson actually had quite a fascination with the Liverpool music scene.
Yeah, and not only that. I mean, I've just read a book about the legendary Roger Eagle, who possibly is as important to Northwest music as Tony Wilson. And there's a passage in the book I've never read before, which is an interview with Tony Wilson, in which he said that the idea for a record label was put in his head by Roger Eagle, who said he was starting an Eric's record label and would Tony like to be on the A&R. And what happened after that was that Wilson blew Roger Eagle out and set up Factory Records in Manchester. And there's even a line, Tony Wilson saying, I don't know if I ever would have had the idea to set up a record label if Roger hadn't asked me. So there's a key kind of part, a key Liverpool element in that particular, you know, chain reaction.
So there's an alternative timeline where Eric's Records is the big deal and New Order are on Eric's 003 or whatever. There we go. Take me through the multiverse to that place. So want to ask you more about that, about the Hacienda, because I remember it opened, I think it's 1982, and I'm a kid. I can't go to clubs, so I'm reading about it in the NME. And everybody's talking about how it's a freezing meat locker with cold concrete floors and industrial girders holding the whole thing up. It was actually quite a long time before the Hacienda found its groove and stopped being a money pit, wasn't it?
Spot on. I mean, from 82 to 88, it struggled financially. It was capacity 1,500 people. Occasionally, it was full-ish for certain bands, or Saturday nights were always quite busy. But it was only when the dance music scene, you know, the technology-driven, the drum machine music came in, that the club became appropriate, if you like, for, you know, for the numbers of people it was originally built for. So Wilson, when he first, I mean, there's a great Channel 4 documentary or interview with him that's available on YouTube. He says, you know, it is necessary for all cities to have their cathedrals for popular culture. Paris and New York have them. And we in Manchester are the only people to found ourselves in a position to furnish the city with such a building. Of course, that was Joy Division royalties basically coming through. You know, what did they do? They didn't go to Monaco or Monte Carlo and or Mile of Man with the traditional Manchester millionaires route to become tax exiles. No, they poured their money into this, you know, into this black hole. And it was only until, it was only when rave music happened that it was like the gods of popular culture had finally smiled on a Hacienda.
I always found it really kind of interesting and kind of encouraging that this kind of explosion of psychedelic, fluorescently coloured, hedonistic celebration basically had its roots, as you just said, paid for by the most existentially agonized monochrome music anyone has ever made, Joy Division. And it gives birth to, you know, the Summer of Love, house music and pure joy.
Yeah. And it, and even further, if we could take it back a darker stage backwards, Peter Saville, who gives me a very interesting interview, says that if you think about it in those terms, then all of it is predicated, it rests on the tragic suicide of Ian Curtis, because you know, the first Joy Division album, Unknown Pleasures, sold a quarter of a million. Following Curtis's death, as we know in music business, death sells. They sold closer, sold 2 million, and it was that money that went to create the Hacienda. And you know, Saville thinks there should be a statue to Ian Curtis in Albert Square. So, yeah, you know, we could trace these things back. And some people think, well, Manchester's got great universities and a very successful airport and all this stuff is just mere juvenilia. But, you know, I'm with Saville on that.
It's interesting, though, you do point out that I think £75,000 towards the doing up of the Hacienda came from the Central Manchester Development Corporation. It wasn't just purely financed by pop music. It's that the gods of development had come on board as well. So I wanted to ask you, what after the Hacienda had kind of established that that destination eventually on Whitworth Street, What were the next key developments? I want to see where the dominoes started to fall after the Hacienda.
Well, I think we can go in two directions. One, we can go down from Whitworth Street West from the Hacienda towards the old Castlefield district, where Colin Sinclair, a young promoter at Salford University, thought the Hacienda is built by 1,500 people, but they're getting 300 or 400 for live gigs, and the sound is atrocious. Often described as akin to a railway station public address system. So why don't I open a little club for bands called The Boardwalk? And it was incredibly successful. And then he expanded it and it became a dance club as well. Now, Colin Sinclair was then sort of yanked out of the world of rock and roll and ended up promoting Manchester's inward investment worldwide. But also in other towards the other end of town, towards the Gay Village. Well, the Gay Village was not the Gay Village. It was Canal Street back in the 80s. Then Carol Ainscow, a Bolton entrepreneur, said, I'm impressed and influenced by what Factory have done with the Hacienda and then their bar Dry on Oldham Street. She kickstarted what's now known as the Gay Village with her bar Manto, which instead of this kind of furtive atmosphere that gay and lesbian people had to sort of endure on Canal Street, was a big open-fronted, and all were welcome to come and have a party. And that's recognised by all communities as what kickstarted the gay village. And then you've got city centre living, turning old buildings like the Hacienda was, Victorian warehouse, turning vacant buildings no one knew what to do with into places to live. And Tom Bloxham of Urban Splash cites Tony Wilson and what he did in Manchester as his inspiration for what is now, you know, the mainstay city centre living. So you can see the physical effects that putting, you know, what Hacienda was called like a giant spaceship landing in the city, the ripple effect that had on the development of what we used to call town and is now this sort of monstrously huge city centre.
Notoriously, the Hacienda had to close down after an invasion of the worsening local gun crime problem. Wilson and the management did their utmost to keep it going, but just couldn't succeed. What did the Hacienda closing mean for the rebirth of Manchester? Because it was harder and harder to conceal the fact that you've got serious crime not far from the city centre.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very turbulent period, and the Hacienda had two short-term closures, one enforced by the police and one voluntarily, where they said, we're sick of this and we're not going to tolerate it anymore. Both times the club reopened. And this, I think, is a pivotal message of my book, because I talked before about the leaders of the city thinking, we've got something the other cities haven't got, a world-famous club. So even though the place had become a carnival of crime, the leaders of the council lobbied the police and the magistrates. They even got the MP, Bob Litherland, to write to the police and the magistrates saying, this is an important place serving the new economy of tourism and leisure. We've got to keep it open. And it did stay open until 1997. But I suppose that is a key point, that in any other city of the world, of course, it would have been shut down as a crime scene. What did Manchester do? No, it's important. People know it around the world. We're going to keep it open.
I suppose, in retrospect, it was probably an unwise move to have crime scene tape as the kind of key visual motif on the girders holding the roof up. Perhaps they predicted their own misfortune there. I don't know. I mean, full disclosure, your own PR agency worked on the launch of major Manchester projects like the Beetham Tower, the Lowry, Urbis, lots of things with the developers Urban Splash. Mm. Andy, can you be fully objective here when you're in on the redevelopment of Manchester?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and one that, you know, I've kind of struggled with. I think the answer to that is I don't work for any of those organisations or businesses anymore, and that working for them gave me insights. I was inside the room where it happened, as opposed to waiting to hear about things after decisions were made. Yeah, it could be. Can be said to be compromised in one respect, but also revelatory in other respects.
With 43 years in the city under your belt, you are now entitled to play the old, you know, it weren't like this in my day card. How do you feel about Manhattan, you know, the new gleaming skyscrapers that tower over everybody? I think you told the Manchester Evening News you felt a bit guilty about being part of that change from the romantic grubbiness of the past.
Yeah, I think I was a little bit unhappy with the headline, which was a sort of dismemberment of a quote. I think the line that I do like to take is that I feel about the city like a fan of an indie band who first saw them in a little club, feels, you know, guilty now they are playing, they're headlining stadiums that my evangelizing played a part in it all. I mean, cities have got to change, and no one could really say that the old Manchester was a better place than today in terms of jobs and activity and life and life chances for people. But it did have a charisma. It did have that grubby charm that some of us miss. And Tony Wilson was right when he said nostalgia is a disease. You know, it's easy to get seduced by the memories. I enjoy Manchester now just as much as I did then. But then I was a 20-year-old and now I'm a 61-year-old. So cities change, people change. You know, one thing that I do point out in the book is the overuse of the Wilson phrase, this is Manchester, we do things differently here. You know, I call it a Mancunian dog whistle used by politicians who wanted to carry favour with the electorate. And you see it everywhere from coffee shops and hotel lobbies. And so those kind of things make, you know, make Wilson, the Hacienda factory, in danger of becoming a cliche, when really we should be valuing all those things for the part they played, but looking forward to a different Manchester going forward.
Of course, if they were quoting Wilson accurately, they'd say, this is Manchester, darling. We do things differently here.
Use that word a lot.
Yeah. Just in closing then, do you think there are lessons for elsewhere from what Manchester managed to do with its pop culture heritage? I mean, like I say, there are a lot of cities with incredible music where it's sort of, you know, Liverpool is great now, but I don't think you could say it was based so much on the pop culture as it is based on football and other things.
Yeah.
Can this kind of thing happen elsewhere? Or do you actually need a local myth maker like Wilson to run around calling everybody darling and transforming the place into a modern legend?
Yeah, I mean, I call it Mancunian exceptionalism, don't I? Because, yeah, Manchester did have Granada TV. You know, we did have national newspaper offices here. You know, we did have advantages that other cities didn't have. But I think all cities should give space to the artists to create their authentic homegrown culture. And that should be away from officialdom, away from corporate interests. Let the authentic voice, if you like, of that place emerge through, you know, music and other forms of art. Because I think once you start to force it, to try and make it happen, even with well-intentioned, often councils try to set up studios, and it comes like a dead hand of bureaucracy. You kind of got to create spaces where artists can get on and do their own thing. And every place, of course, has got its own history and its own qualities. They need to be allowed to express themselves.
What's your favourite Manchester band and what's your favourite Manchester record?
Oh, I'd have to say Buzzcocks. I don't mind.
We'll stick a link to that in the show notes. Andy Spinoza, thanks so much for joining me and talking to us.
Pleasure. Brilliant.
Manchester Unspun, Pop, Property and Power in the Original Modern City is available now from all good booksellers. We'll put a link in the show notes again. And if you want to support other important regeneration projects, why not consider backing The Bunker on Patreon? You'll be helping to pay the wages of young worker bee producers and editors as they toil away in our own sumptuous Hacienda, which is also a freezing cold basement held up by industrial beams. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. We are 24-hour podcast people. See you next time.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Bunker was presented by Andrew Harrison. Lead producer is Jacob Jarvis. Group editor, Andrew Harrison. Audio productions by me, Robin Leeburn. And the theme tune is by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.